everyone. I'm Danny Rowdy of DannyRowdy.com, and today I'm talking with painter, philosopher, biologist Raymond Peet. In this hour-long episode, we'll talk about calcium as the cause and solution to many health problems, why an excess of phosphorus is a serious source of stress, in addition to talking about libertarianism, the power elite's obsession with eugenics, and the prominent role of CIA fascist spymaster Alan Dulles in shaping the world we live in today. In addition to thanking Ray for talking with me today, I'd like to thank my patrons for making this show and all the content I produce possible. If you would like to become a patron, please go to patreon.com/Danny Rowdy. Ray's newsletter is available by email now. It's $28 for a total of 6 newsletters delivered bi-monthly, and you can subscribe by sending $28 to raypeetsnewsletter@gmail.com. As always, please do your own research and come to your own conclusions, and in the spirit of William Blake, the true method of knowledge is experiment. Without further ado, here's the show. I could just read you this Adele Davis quote that you had in your calcium article as a starter, but she says, "It is extremely important to realize that calcium deposits in soft tissues become worse when the diet is low in calcium. Persons suffering from arthritis, bursitis, scleroderma, hardening of the arteries, and any abnormality where calcium deposits or spurs may cause pain are often afraid to eat foods rich in calcium. Actually, they can never improve until their calcium and magnesium intakes are adequate." And that inspired my email to you about doing this episode of, I think you had mentioned it in some podcast, of the idea that calcium is not only the solution to many of the health problems, but it's also the cause of many of the health problems. And so I think maybe that gets into David McCarron's work, but I thought that was like an interesting concept that was probably of fundamental importance to understand.
Yeah, and that was 50 years ago that she wrote that. At least. And that's just horrifying to see how the medical journals now, about 80 or 90% of the people talking about calcium, at least 90%, completely miss that information that she had back in 1960.
And you think that's possibly an extension of just this incorrect view of the cell? Is that how they are getting it so wrong?
Yeah, I don't think she knew anything about Gilbert Ling, but she did read. That's the difference. She was reading stuff in general and just accumulating information. That is what you have to conclude, even without knowing the principles of the gel nature of cytoplasm and how gels work, what pH does to a gel and its affinity for minerals. But that work had been going on for 20 or 30 years before Gilbert Ling wrote his stuff. And so it was in the culture and people just staying awake, just like Adele Davis accumulated it by reading nutrition.
You frequently mention David McCarron and reference his articles, and he has a slew of articles in, I think, the late 80s and 90s. Was his work not respected, or was it not acknowledged?
He got fired from a California university, I think UC Berkeley, and went to Oregon, where they were too backward to see how dangerous he was.
And the dangerous message was the calcium anti-hypertensive effect?
Yeah, stop talking about salt and giving people diuretics. The medical business had been killing them already for 30 years. And when he said that it's calcium deficiency, not sodium excess, and they had to fire him and send him to the backwoods.
You mentioned the gel-like nature of the cell. Can I read you a little summary of the cell, and then you can stop me if I'm horribly wrong? It's very simple, but it might be good just to nail down some things or like terms or a glossary. So if there's sufficient thyroid, ATP is the final end product of the food materials we consume. The healthy resting state, ATP polarizes a cell, meaning that it sustains the protein, water, solute structure, preferentially absorbing potassium and magnesium and naturally excluding sodium and calcium. And then the depletion of ATP leads to the depolarized state where a cell is vulnerable. And then the depletion of ATP, it also breaks down into ADP, like a lower energy molecule, and you lose the complex of magnesium with ATP, and you also lose phosphate, and then the ADP complexes with calcium. And then this is the general state that leads to the reductive stress, the low carbon dioxide, the high lactic acid, and then the shift in the intracellular and extracellular pH.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, things are streaming. Oxygen and sugar are streaming in, and CO2 is streaming out, dragging the unnecessary minerals with it.
The switch between the polarized and depolarized, is that a natural phenomenon, or should a cell not necessarily need to shift into that disorderly water depolarized state?
Gilbert Ling showed that when he poisoned the energy-producing systems, glycolysis and oxidation, that cells retained their polarization for longer than 24 hours, just sitting there essentially dead. And meanwhile, sodium and calcium were bouncing in the cell and bouncing right back out again, so that they kept their polarization despite the motion across the surface and into the near regions of the cytoplasm and then back out.
I haven't looked at that paper for a long time. It was always semi-confusing because if he's doing a stress test or energy depletion of the cell, how is it not becoming depolarized?
He didn't excite them. He kept them quiet, and they were reptile cells that could stand being cold. So he kept them cold so that there wasn't depletion of the energy. The energy just stayed there, stuck to the proteins.
I had written to him a long time ago asking him about carbon dioxide and as a cardinal adsorbent. I think he had mentioned that more research was needed or something similar. But you see the carbon dioxide as something essential for maintaining the resting living state or the polarized.
Yeah, I asked him something about carbon dioxide about 25 years ago, and he described an experiment he had done in graduate school that exactly answered my question. It explained what they call the lactate paradox of high altitude, where you can work full speed at high altitude without producing lactic acid the way you would at low altitude. And he did it in the lab, basically showing that cells don't fully depolarize even when they're stimulated and working if they have a good supply of carbon dioxide. So in the lab, he showed the CO2 was preventing full depolarization. And that's why you see it at high altitude. You don't depolarize enough to shift from oxidation to lactic acid production.
I think somewhere you said that frequently depolarized cells can lead to this pathology of being killed in the process or the excitotoxicity and cancer, basically.
Yeah, the cell depends on, at first, using its internal glycogen to get the sugar it needs to produce carbon dioxide. And if that's depleted, then it starts using any amino acids or fatty acids to oxidize, and they produce less carbon dioxide and will turn on the wasteful process of producing lactic acid, and that just starts a vicious circle.
The fats producing less carbon dioxide is one of the aspects of that, the pyruvate decarboxylation, because that produces some CO2 and something about oxygen economy or something?
The carbohydrates carry their own oxygen. Each carbon already has part of the carbon dioxide, where with fat, you have to start with molecular oxygen. There's no oxygen built into the fat molecule. You use the oxygen to produce the carbon dioxide for each atom of carbon in the fat, where with carbohydrate, you use only half of the oxygen molecule because there's already one oxygen atom attached to the carbon.
It's funny, there was a large ketogenic diet person on a very popular podcast, and I think the interviewer was like, "What else are you researching right now?" And it was something about carbon dioxide. And so it was just funny to see like his whole lifestyle and ketogenic diets was like the antithesis of his like newfound interest in carbon dioxide.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about magnesium. I found a little snippet. Do you remember Andrew Kim, like very smart gentleman that's like basically left the internet? So Andrew had written, magnesium or potassium is needed to form the phosphorylated ATPase that then upon exposure to calcium or sodium transfers a phosphate group to ADP generating ATP. So in short, magnesium helps to retain and generate ATP. And then you had called magnesium the basic protective calcium blocker.
Yeah.
Was he right in what he said? Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay. But the reason why I mentioned magnesium is a lot of times you talk about something like calcium, and then there's an immediate need to interject with how much more important magnesium is than calcium.
Yeah, and at the same time you're making ATP, you're subtracting some phosphate, inorganic phosphate, from the environment to get rid of its excitatory effect.
The breakdown of ATP can increase the intracellular phosphate, but is the same thing occurring when a person is just eating way more phosphate than sodium and magnesium and calcium?
Similar, it tends to push it in, and fructose has the property of lowering intracellular phosphate, and the phosphatases are very self-protective in general. Getting the proteins unphosphorylated puts them into the resting state. When you stick a phosphate onto a protein covalently, it tends to change its whole behavior. The whole cell goes into the excited state. But even before it gets there, gets attached enzymically, it's pulling the water system away from the resting state. So my interpretation of muscle contraction or nerve excitation isn't that there is some little motor that runs on the so-called high-energy bond. The way they usually picture it is that the energy from the so-called high-energy bond goes into some kind of a motor, and that's what is happening rather than the parts that are left behind. But one of my good professors, Sidney Bernhard, I mentioned that in 1959, I saw that he had shown that there is no high-energy bond in ATP. And I said, why does everyone talk about the high-energy bond? A famous guy from England had just been at the university that week, and he never said very much, but he said, not everyone does.
Well, Gilbert says it in his 2001 book. He says, Scow presented his sodium pump hypothesis. Podolsky and Morales demonstrated that the high-energy phosphate bond concept was in serious trouble.
Yeah, it was in 59. It was killed by Sidney Bernhard.
But, I mean, that it's still common talk today, correct?
Yeah, horrifyingly. It makes you miss the whole thing that's happening, which is that you don't want that free phosphate messing up your water system.
Sorry if I missed it. It's interfering with the ordering of the water, the differentiation between what you called the wild or the bulk water and the orderly oriented water. But what is it doing to specifically de-energize the cell? You said it was excitotoxic. Is that increasing some messenger or something to de-energize the mitochondria?
No messenger, just the whole system changes the way it's lined up. Like if you have a bunch of soldiers lined up in rows, and then you say, give an order, and suddenly the whole thing melts and there's no longer any rows. That sort of a whole phase transition is what's happening. And that's the problem with the receptor idea, that everything, to some extent, is a receptor. When you have 1,000 different things getting ordered differently, when it's in one state than in the other, the order that has been kept in the proper positions melts as a whole process, not as a series of isolated processes.
Okay, so it sounds like I'm thinking about phosphate a little too simply.
Like melting water or anything, or freezing it. You can cool water well below 0 degrees Celsius and still have liquid water. But given the right trigger, suddenly all of the molecules can cooperate in such a way that they freeze up.
So you could call phosphate like a depolarizer, basically, in excess?
Yeah.
And then that would lead to the cell just having to make the choice of dying or being killed.
Yeah. If it can't find its internal resources of ideally the glycogen and oxygen, if something cuts off its oxygen and glucose supply, then it starts eating itself and it's in danger of disintegrating. And it can do that in more or less organized ways. if it's taken too by surprise, it can dump its innards out in very distressing ways. But if it is gradual enough that it is deprived of energy, then it can get itself organized so that it makes its internal materials available to other parts of the organism. So when you're exercising one set of muscles, if you go about it gradually, you can build those up and not subtract too much from the others because you're feeding what they need. But if you are very intense in your exercise, if it's stressful, then the cortisol gets the material by shutting off the oxygen sugar use in idle cells, causing them to slowly release their material that can be used by the active cells to build them up. So stress hormones partly are there to prevent toxic death of cells, make it an orderly disintegration that can help the other parts of the organism.
What you just said reminded me of a Cellier quote where he was saying that everything is being affected equally, but there is like a weakest link somewhere in there that can lead to some specific pathology. Do you think that's the right idea?
Yeah, it's the working system. It's an adaptive process that feeds support into the system that's working and functioning. The idea of the functional system, it includes the way your brain is working too. Habits are sort of a functional system. You integrate your thoughts and your digestive processes and your muscle activities around a way of living, and that supports that pattern. So you tend to get in a rut if you don't have things to interrupt and give you a more general way of functioning.
The brain is what is it born into the culture, and then the culture culture lives in the nervous system. And then Maslow said something like the culture should be like an adaptive tool, and so that being essential in a person's reactivity to certain stresses.
Yeah, the social system should be intelligent, basically, and then it wouldn't degrade the participants in it. But when the social system is designed unintelligently, participating in it is a degrading process. Maslow said it a lot more elegantly.
Well, I always like reading your stuff. And I'll see something from Maslow or see something from Rogers, and it will make me understand your work a little bit better.
I had been reading Freud and the Freudians for 6 months when I found Maslow's book, and it was a tremendous experience, just the way he spoke.
Was he thought of as like crackpot at the time? Because I haven't found anything that haven't liked about him so far.
Yeah, he was a great irritant to the Freudians who were still there, and the new behaviorists were coming on, and they didn't think he was at all scientific.
Do you feel similarly about Rogers? I know you had a criticism about him.
Yeah, his approach was great for the union breakers. They immediately saw that, and one of his collaborators on the book, The Sciences of Man, I think it was called, his co-author, said that his approach was good for the tobacco industry. So Cellier was a cigarette promoter, but Rogers, his first book, Client-Centered Therapy, the back part of it gives the philosophical basis. It's a very good description of phenomenology. It's philosophically very good, but it can be made bad use of by bad people.
So if I understand what you're saying, the bad part about it not wanting to
attack and criticize.
Okay. And is that a bad part of client-centered therapy? Because, I mean, he wasn't interjecting.
Yeah. Maslow would just buddy in and say, you're feeling messed up because you're dealing with a horrible situation, and just get out of that situation.
To play devil's advocate, somebody might be like, well, that's an authoritarian way of approaching things, but...
But a direct way of being anti-authoritarian can look authoritarian, but it isn't. And actually, the super anti-authoritarian Rogers followers end up leaving the authoritarians in place.
Well, that's kind of funny. I swear I'm not obsessed with libertarianism, but it seems like they say we're non-authoritarian, so we're going to get rid of the government and then break up into these small groups.
Oh, yeah, that's the Koch brothers and their ilk. They pose as anti-authoritarians, libertarians, because they want to have absolute power. They really would like to own the government, but if people still insist on voting and things, then they want to break up the government entirely and then have their own governing system.
And they want all types of different freedom, in quotes, except they don't want economic freedom.
Yeah, they want the army and their way of controlling the money system.
There was a website called, I think it was the Naked Capitalism, and they had a series of articles called Journey into a Libertarian Future. And the series was satirical, but they were using real quotes from a person. I think the name was Hans Hermann Hoppe. And it was enlightening, not only because a lot of the libertarians I'm aware of seem to be genetic determinists, but the author was also, he seemed to have like a misanthropic contempt for humanity and using phrases, I think, like a natural authority and favoring the elite. So it's just a pretty eye-opening of something that I used to consider to be very anti-authoritarian.
Have you read any of Murray Bookchin's books or articles?
No.
He was a good libertarian compared to the Koch type.
You had mentioned Joe Roman, antiwar.com. Joe Romano, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Those are pretty good libertarians. They don't want to kill everyone. They consider themselves the archaic conservatives. I forget the term, but they're the old-fashioned conservatives who actually believe in freedom rather than freedom to control everyone else.
Something else libertarians often talk about is the non-aggression principle. That might sound good just at face value, but based on Hans Selye's or your work of stress, the non-aggression principle really doesn't make any sense when you stress a person to fight for their survival. And if you have to provide for yourself or your family, or you or your family are going to die, who cares about the non-aggression principle?
Yeah, there's the reality problem.
Okay, do you want to switch gears a little bit and talk about parathyroid hormone and serotonin? Because you're the only person I know of that makes the connection between the two. And so what's happening exactly? I know the low thyroid or hyperventilation or too much estrogen and low thyroid and excess of estrogen tend to promote the loss of carbon dioxide and hyperventilation. And that's causing the platelets are carrying the serotonin that's primarily produced in the intestine. And the platelets are becoming leaky and the serotonin's leaking out. And that's activating the parathyroid glands.
Yeah, the place that should be normal is in lactation. The serotonin turns on prolactin, and the prolactin is parallel to the parathyroid hormone. Both of those break down the bone to provide extra calcium for lactation. So the serotonin works systematically in a logical way to make milk. But when hypothyroidism is the reason for excess serotonin, hypothyroidism in itself, because you're not producing very much carbon dioxide by not using oxygen much, any little exertion tends to use up your energy and you have to then resort to glycolysis and produce the lactic acid and inflammatory state. And hypothyroid people run at a higher level of histamine, serotonin, and usually adrenaline too. Everything is using the emergency system unnecessarily. Just a background state of a very hypothyroid person is hyperventilating in the sense of running around with those processes turned on. So when they go to a higher altitude and get even less oxygen and breathe faster, their hyperventilation becomes visible. But anyone, if they're driven to breathe faster than they should, if they use up their carbon dioxide, anything that makes you like an inflammation that produces lactic acid and serotonin will turn on hyperventilation and stop the adequate production of carbon dioxide. And that sets in motion the things like causing the platelets to release more serotonin and the serotonin activating the prolactin and parathyroid hormone. It causes chronic breakdown of your bones.
And something you had said that I thought was super fascinating, you said that you ideally, like in a Vernadskian ideal state where the organism was realized in like a really good environment, you would barely need your hormones. And I was thinking about parathyroid hormone I was thinking about it too simplistically of just being suppressed by calcium, potassium, magnesium, or sodium. But like you just said, the primary thing holding it down is carbon dioxide. And so if the atmosphere just spontaneously increased in carbon dioxide, you would need less of your hormones because they're having this adaptive function.
Yeah, and an atmosphere rich in carbon dioxide is going to produce lots of sugary fruit and make the diet easier to keep the carbohydrate up, as well as the atmosphere keeping you from wasting your glucose.
Is there much information on the Carboniferous period? Is that that's when the Earth had an extremely high concentration of carbon dioxide?
Yeah, there are lots of coal deposits that show what was going on there.
Wasn't there like a rapid evolutionary escalation?
Just a burst of innovation biologically.
Is that on a cycle? Could something like that be estimated to occur in the future sometime? Or
there are people working on the idea of cycles of the Earth more or less coordinated with cycles of the sun. There are different opinions about whether you can have an approximate idea of when that's going to happen. But the smaller cycles, the ice ages, are somewhat easier to see meaningful cycles in. In 1940, the consensus was that a new ice age was approaching. The temperatures had been warming in the first part of the century, but it looked like they were now regressing. And that opinion stuck around from 1940 when I was in high school. It was in the magazines and such. And as recently as 1974, 75, Time Magazine and New York Times, and then in 1979, another article in New York Times, they were talking about an oncoming ice age again from 1940 to 1979. But then Three Mile Island scared people about nuclear power, and that scared the Pentagon that they would lose their nuclear fuel for making bombs. And almost immediately they came out with a theory that carbon dioxide was going to create a too hot planet. No more talk about the ice age that had been discussed for 35 years.
I've heard that before, and somebody was detailing the transition between, he called them the oligarchs, or the Rockefeller Standard Oil, have transitioned into the green movement. And those are all the same people saying, don't have children, and humans are cancer on this planet. And also saying things like the carbon dioxide is bad. But they were detailing the transition from being scared of global cooling to this new fear of global warming.
Yeah, people are a cancer because now we have automation and don't need workers. Where the Rockefeller Foundation, starting in the early 1900s, was pioneering disease prevention because they needed healthy workers. And now that there's automation, it would be very economical to get rid of about 4 or 5 billion workers.
Upon watching that documentary, they were talking about Standard Oil producing mustard gas and then mustard gas being resynthesized into chemotherapy.
Oh, yeah. Basically, one of my favorite examples of research financing was Elwood Jensen. It was a government-financed chemical warfare person working on things better than cyanide for killing people. And the government transitioned him right into working on estrogen. And around that time, estrogen became a big government as well as industry topic, with cancer institutes taking up the study of estrogen. And Elwood Jensen invented the estrogen receptor. The government gave him the only radioactively labeled estrogen to do his research with. And using that, he said that there is no metabolism of estrogen by the uterus. So all you people studying enzymology to explain how estrogen works, you're wrong. It's just hitting the receptor, no metabolism. It turns on the genes, and the genes turn on femaleness. And then 15 or 20 years later, other people had access to the various isotopes that they could show, yes, the uterus does metabolize estrogen. But meanwhile, everyone had adopted the idea of a receptor turning on genes.
Do you think Elwood Jensen's research was being guided by the hand of these eugenics fanatics people?
Yeah, I think the chemical warfare and estrogen Pentagon people are all clearly doing that. As a sidelight, they are seeing that inducing cancer almost instantly can be a useful tool for the military.
Well, I might as well mention it because I've talked about it, but it's James James Corbett's How Big Oil Conquered the World and then Why Big Oil Conquered the World. And he just very precisely documents how obsessed the elite people were with eugenics and how that was, and you've talked about it extensively, and it just seems very deep-rooted of the class system of we're useless eaters and things like of that nature.
The whole genetics movement itself, genetics, not eugenics, grew out of that motivation. The original famous geneticists were also eugenicists, and the Journal of Eugenics, after Hitler became a target of scorn, the eugenics journal changed its name to Human Genetics. And just after I got my PhD, I wrote an article in the graduate student newspaper and mentioned that fact that the eugenics people were still around, still teaching genetics, but that they were embarrassed, and mentioned the Journal of Eugenics in the library. That week, all of the old volumes disappeared.
Not to go too off track, but wasn't Hitler was funded by the one of the Dulles brothers, or not just...
No, they were his employees, but Standard Oil and several of the big banks, the Bush family and some of the big Democrat. I guess they were at times in the State Department, but in the banks primarily, they were financing the fascists by the end of and through the war. And as the war was declared, Roosevelt's government declared that, I think it was Alan Dulles was officially declared a German enemy agent temporarily, but then very shortly after that, he was put into the Secret Service or the OSS, I think it was called. And then the CIA and his brother put into the State Department. And if you look at the whole 10 or 15 years history of how those corporate powers were treating Roosevelt, in 1933, they had organized a coup and they recruited Marine Corps General Smedley Butler to lead the army into Washington to put him out of office. And he gathered information as they were communicating between the corporations through intermediaries with Butler. And he took the information to Congress and said, look, these big corporations are planning a coup. Congress investigated and confirmed what he said, but then did nothing. After 12 more years, they were influential in putting Truman in as vice president in place of Henry Wallace, because Wallace had gone on record as favoring a continuation of Roosevelt's anti-war policies. Alan Dulles was, meanwhile, in charge of European negotiations. He, just a week or two before Roosevelt's death, Alan Dulles was secretly and against instructions agreed upon by Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. Alan Dulles was making deals with the Nazis to have the Nazis not fight the Americans and to go fight the Russians. Truman heard about it and said that information must be false because no one would do that. Stalin heard about it first, and that was how Roosevelt heard about it, but Stalin just has no judgment to think that could happen. And then within a few days, Roosevelt conveniently died before he had to accuse Dulles of the treason he was involved in. And Dulles then made deals with the German intelligence apparatus and unified the U.S. intelligence system with the Nazi system. And that's what has set the course of history.
I guess there was a story about Alan Dulles' son, who I guess was having like some psychotic problem or alleged psychotic problem. And he would say things like, my dad is a Nazi spy. And the author of wherever I had read this said, but he never said that again after they gave him his anti-psychotic medication.
Probably hurt so much.
But the person, I think Tarpley said this, that possibly had poisoned Roosevelt was the painter woman. Do you have any perspective on that?
There was talk about the inhalant that he used while he was being painted, just putting a little too much benzedrine or something in the inhalant. He sniffed it, held his head, and had an excruciating pain in his head after sniffing his inhalant. And then that inhalant disappeared.
I had never heard that connection between Dulles and Roosevelt. And so he's very implicated in like two high-profile presidential assassinations.
Oh, yeah. And have you heard any of the connections of Lee Harvey Oswald's landlady?
No.
And De Morin Schildt? Lee Harvey Oswald's landlady, who was working with De Morin Schildt, who was a 35-year associate of Dulles, they were both helping Lee Harvey Oswald get jobs, like in the convenient book building in Dallas. And his landlady was a very close family friend of the Dulleses. Both of the people managing his movements for the last few months of his life were close, longtime associates of Alan Dulles's.
When you're going through life and you're hearing these certain things, are you just wondering what's really going on? When you're hearing that Kennedy was assassinated and things like that?
No, my first thought was that Kennedy was such a bad man. No wonder. But then immediately within a week or so, I realized it was a coup for putting an even worse man in office.
And I think Douglas, maybe Tarpley said, but we don't know who the new Alan Dulles is right now. But he's certain, maybe you do, but he certainly set a precedent of things to come, which are still, I guess, unraveling right now.
Yeah, Alan Dulles started associating with that banker by politician crowd when he was about 10 years old. So he had real skill and background in how to maneuver through the political criminal world. And I don't think there's anyone with such an extreme international social background operating. So I think they're basically a lot of klutzes.
I only have a single other question to ask you. I get the feeling, and I could be wrong, from reading occasionally, being privy to various responses, the best page I feel like on the Repeat forum is the link to your email wiki, which people compile your responses, which I think can be very valuable. And it seems like occasionally you've mentioned that pregnenolone, progesterone, and DHEA and or thyroid aren't as effective if the vitamin D and or calcium are low. And my question was, I know that PTH can inhibit mitochondrial respiration, but is it such a powerful break on the metabolism that getting the vitamin D and the calcium or carbon dioxide in order would just be important for having these other things work effectively?
You have to include sodium and a lot of other things in there, but yeah, it's one of the adequate breaks on the system.
Is that because of the specific actions of parathyroid hormone, or is it because it causes mast cells to release serotonin and other things like that?
Yeah, it's part of a system, so in itself is very powerful. The vitamin D and calcium are working on other things too, and so you can't say that they're only working on the parathyroid hormone. They work on the serotonin and prolactin and growth hormone, essentially everything in themselves to different degrees.
When I think about introing somebody into a lot of this information, it seems relatively easy to go get your vitamin D measured and then to use it. I guess is that something you feel comfortable consulting to large amounts of random people? It seems like something fairly safe to talk about.
Yeah.
Okay, Ray, that's all I had for you. Hey, you know what? Do you want to touch on progesterone real quick? I know that just online there was a general confusion where people were misconstruing things about progesterone that you might want to clear up.
Oh yeah. People have been saying completely imaginary things. I imagine someone wanting to sell a product other than Progest-E complex must have made them up, because they have no connection to reality. That I had nothing to do with the Progest-E formula. It's exactly the formula that I developed in 1976 and has been exactly the same thing all these years. But people have been saying that they added estrogenic substances to it. A lot of people saying that they get estrogen symptoms. It is the usual internet placebo, negative placebo suggestibility, but the story, the formula has changed. It seems to have been repeatedly promoted on some of the internet discussion places.
Lastly, can we just touch on a tiny bit on why somebody might have a strange reaction to progesterone? You mentioned that when estrogen is being eliminated, it can pass through an inflamed tissue, and in the tissue can contain a large amount of beta-glucuronidase, and that will remove the glucuronic acid, leaving pure estrogen to accumulate in the tissues. It's not unheard of that somebody similar to thyroid or anything that's safe, it depends on the system it's going into. And if the person is extremely estrogenic.
Except that when you're talking about a whole system, the progesterone is also protecting against the inflamed system with its beta-glucuronidase. And so it's tending to stop that process too. So the more you take, basically, the more stable everything is. It inhibits the glucuronidase and the sulfatase, which reactivate estrogen, and it activates the transferases of sulfate and glucuronide to inactivate estrogen, and it has a similarly organized effect on the various dehydrogenases that reduce the activity of estradiol, and the opposing systems, it has the same protective effect on preventing the activation of estrone back to estradiol. So everything progesterone does in reference to estrogen, there are at least 11 things that I've counted that it consistently, everywhere you look, is anti-estrogenic. So I think it's all a suggestibility. One of the first times I experienced that was a pregnant woman said progesterone was having some strange effect, and I asked her how much she had taken, and she said she put it on her wrist, a dime size area on her wrist, and she had heard about transdermal use of scopolamine or such thing for travel sickness, and she was putting one drop in one spot and thinking it should have an effect. If you take a minuscule amount and then look at your symptoms, you're bound to notice some symptom that has nothing to do with the microscopic amount you've absorbed.
So besides not taking enough, which you've detailed in your progesterone summaries article, I think you've also mentioned things like thyroid function being too low and or vitamin D deficiency could cause those symptoms, not necessarily because of the progesterone, but because of these other inflammatory aspects that the person is already dealing with.
One person said she had no effect from taking 100 milligrams, a fourth of a teaspoon of the Progesti, and I asked her to repeat the dose. She took as much as 400 milligrams a teaspoon and still didn't feel anything. And when she had her blood tested, her estrogen was the highest I've ever seen. It was 100 times higher than the estrogen should have been. And when your estrogen reaches a certain point, there's no absorptive capacity, no carrying capacity into the blood that can carry enough progesterone to have an effect. And for those people, it's necessary to work on the liver, feeding the liver protein or B vitamins, whatever it needs to start detoxifying the estrogen and increase the thyroid if necessary to make the liver metabolize the estrogen.
Well, similarly, I remember you saying that if you were drinking milk or orange juice, presuming that the orange juice was sweet and not tart or sour, that it could cause, some people will say like, oh, it really bloats me. And in my experience, my experience was made more clear by you saying that, oh, sometimes when you drink liquids, it makes inflammation in the intestine more noticeable. I thought that was really profound because not only did I feel like I really had experienced it, but many people will say similar things. And I think it's maybe just speaking to the prevalency of intestinal inflammation.
Yeah, and the word bloat has various meanings. Some people who have 1 or 2 ounces of liquid around their intestines, verified by ultrasound or such, just a small amount of fluid in the abdominal cavity can create a sensation of fullness. And some people refer to that as bloat or an enlarged uterus. Some people feel bloated. But when it's digestive, if you aren't digesting your carbohydrate, the bacteria can produce a large amount of gas. And the usual traditional meaning of bloat was accumulated gas. And the test for that is just to thump your belly with your fingers. You can tap it in different places and find exactly where there's a gas deposit, if there is.
I think that's all the questions I had for you. What are you working on right now, Ray?
Cholesterol and then progesterone will be my next newsletters, thinking about the evolutionary, in every sense, implications and meaning of cholesterol and progesterone.
Awesome. You have been so generous with your time. My sincere thanks. Thank you so much, Ray. It's always a pleasure, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks.
That's going to conclude this week's episode. I'd like to thank Ray again for talking with me today, along with my patrons for their support of the show and all the content I produce. If I didn't have patrons, I couldn't do any of this, so I sincerely appreciate it. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please hit the like button on YouTube and leave a comment or a constructive criticism below. I always say this, but I have an amazing listenership, and I'm extremely fortunate for anybody to care about anything that I do. This show was extremely fun for me, and it just seemed like a nice, free-flowing conversation. It's actually the second conversation that we had done. I first got Ray on the phone, and we talked about calcium. Then I had to fill in some gaps with that show, and I got him on the phone again. And I liked the second conversation so much better that I decided to go with that one. I will probably release snippets from the first show just to tie everything together. But really, thanks to Ray for getting on the phone with me twice and bearing with me through these questions. So thank you so much, Ray. And thanks again for listening. I'll talk to you guys soon.